I slept too little and drank too much.
What's the idea with this anyway? You get out of bed like this? Oh, Christ.
Rise and shine with CKUT 90.3 FM.
The following is a previously broadcast program.
Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. You count on Democracy Now! To stay focused on the stories that matter most. We count on you to support our independent journalism. If everyone who tunes in to Democracy Now! Signed up for a monthly donation of just $10, we could cover our operating costs for the entire year. Really, that's all it would take. Please do your part today by visiting us at democracynow.org. Stay safe, wear a mask, and thank you so much. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
Let's remember, that's what Pinochet did. He ran Operation Condor, picked up people all over the world, took them into penal sites, tortured them and killed them. What is the difference, I would ask the American people, between us and Pinochet on this?
As the 20th anniversary of the opening of the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo approaches, we look at the life and legacy of the pioneering radical lawyer Michael Ratner, who spent decades in the courts and in the streets fighting U.S. imperialism, including leading the effort to win habeas corpus rights for prisoners held at Guantanamo after the September 11th attacks. Michael died 5 years ago, but his memoir was recently published. It's titled Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer. We'll hear Michael Ratner in his own words and speak to three people who knew him well.
All his life, Michael Ratner was a siren about the horrors of U.S. militarism across the world. And so possibly no one was better suited to predict the violence and creeping authoritarianism that would emerge following 9/11. Possibly no one else had the vision, courage, and resilience that Michael Ratner showed in responding to the human rights crisis created by the Bush administration, including in his decision to intervene, the first lawyers to intervene to challenge arbitrary and indefinite detention and torture in Guantanamo.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Congress has approved a bill to extend federal funding into early December, averting a government shutdown just hours before a midnight deadline Thursday. The stopgap measure won the support of enough Republicans to pass only after Democrats agreed to drop a provision that would suspend a limit on the national debt. Without action on the debt ceiling, the U.S. could default on its loans in mid-October. Meanwhile, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi delayed a planned vote Thursday on a trillion-dollar infrastructure bill amidst fractures in the Democratic Party over the Build Back Better Act, the 10-year, $3.5 trillion package to expand the social safety net and combat the climate emergency. West Virginia Democratic Senator Joe Manchin told reporters Thursday he'd only accept a 10-year, $1.5 trillion social safety net bill.
My top line has been 1.5 because I believe in my heart that what we can do and what the needs we have right now and what we can afford to do without basically changing our whole society to an entitlement mentality.
Progressive Democrats say they won't vote for an infrastructure bill until Senate Democrats move on the reconciliation bill containing the Biden administration's top legislative priorities. Representative Pramila Jayapal, chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, tweeted, "By allowing one bill to advance without the Build Back Better Act alongside it, we leave behind child care, paid leave, health care, climate action, education, and a roadmap to citizenship. We're not going to leave working people, families, and our communities behind," Congressmember Jayapal wrote. Immigrant justice advocates are condemning a federal appeals court ruling that will allow the Biden administration to continue mass expelling asylum seekers without due process under Title 42, citing the pandemic as justification. Last month, a lower court issued a temporary ban on the Trump-era policy, which was set to go into effect today. ACLU attorney Lee Gelernt, who led the ACLU's lawsuit against Title 42, said, quote, if the administration's making the political calculation that if it acts inhumanely now, it can act more humanely later, that calculation is misguided and of little solace to the families that are being sent to Haiti or brutalized in Mexico right now, he said. This comes as CBS News reports the Biden administration's deported at least 5,400 Haitian asylum seekers using Title 42 in the last 11 days. Meanwhile, four United Nations agencies, including the Human Rights Office, are urging countries to stop deporting Haitian asylum seekers without first properly assessing their claims, a violation of international law. The United States reported more than 2,700 COVID-19 deaths Thursday, as the official U.S. pandemic death toll rapidly approached 700,000. Today, the drug company Merck announced it's seeking emergency use of its antiviral drug molnupiravir from the FDA and other regulators around the world after a late-stage clinical trial showed it reduced the risk of hospitalization or death in COVID-19 patients by about half. If approved, the pill would be the first oral antiviral treatment for COVID-19. Several Democratic House members share their own experiences of getting abortions during a hearing Thursday amidst a mounting assault on reproductive rights across the United States. California Congressmember Barbara Lee said she was just 16 when she had to travel to Mexico for a so-called back alley abortion in the days before Roe v. Wade. Lee said she was one of the lucky ones for surviving the procedure. Meanwhile, Congressmember Cori Bush said she had an abortion after being raped at 17.
So to all the black women and girls who have had abortions and will have abortions, we have nothing to be ashamed of. We live in a society that has failed to legislate love and justice for us. So we deserve better. We demand better. We are worthy of better. So that's why I'm here to tell my story. So today I sit before you as that nurse, as that pastor, as that pastor, as that activist, that survivor, that single mom, that congresswoman, to testify that in the summer of 1994, I was raped, I became pregnant, and I chose to have an abortion.
A bill banning abortions at 8 weeks in Cori Bush's home state of Missouri was passed in 2019, but is on hold during legal challenges. Missouri Republicans say they plan on introducing an even more restrictive measure modeled on Texas's near-total abortion ban. Washington's Pramila Jayapal also testified at Thursday's hearing. A new study in The Lancet finds over half of all police killings in the United States go unreported in government data. That represents over 17,000 deaths at the hands of the police since 1980. Police killings of black Americans is the most undercounted, at a rate of 60%. The police also kill black people at a disproportionate rate that's 3.5 times higher than white people. In Lebanon, survivors of last year's devastating blast at the port of Beirut took to the streets to protest the recent suspension of investigation into the deadly incident. Prior to the suspension, top officials moved to dismiss the lead investigator, Judge Tariq Bitar, from the case. This is Karine Hitti, who lost both her husband and her brother in the explosion.
The judge is getting threatened by politicians and by everyone he is trying to accuse. I don't know how the suspects have the right to submit a complaint to doubt the judge's impartiality. They are suspects. They should be investigated and have to prove they are innocent.
In El Salvador, thousands of people took to the streets of the capital, San Salvador, for another round of protests against President Nayib Bukele and El Salvador's adoption of Bitcoin as an official currency. Critics warn of drastic fluctuations in cryptocurrency's value and worry about the economic impacts on poorer communities. This is one of the protesters.
Sí, la ley del DICOM, no estamos de acuerdo.
We do not agree with the Bitcoin law. We want the law to be removed because it's money laundering in our country. Also, regarding the Constitution, we have a good Constitution. The problem is that Bukele wants to be reelected and he wants to change the Constitution.
Opponents are accusing President Bukele of being a dictator. You can go to democracynow.org to see our latest interview on Salvador adopting Bitcoin as currency. This comes as last month, Salvadoran Supreme Court judges who were recently appointed by Bukele's political party ruled that the president could seek a second consecutive term, which until now has been prohibited in El Salvador. Here in New York, environmental and human rights lawyer Stephen Danziger is being sentenced today after over 2 years under house arrest on pretrial misdemeanor charges. He's been targeted by Chevron ever since he successfully sued the oil giant in Ecuador on behalf of 30,000 Amazonian indigenous people for dumping 16 billion gallons of oil into their ancestral land. This week, UN human rights experts called Danziger's house arrest arbitrary and in violation of international law, calling for his immediate release and reparations. A warning to viewers, this next story contains graphic images of animal abuse. Animal rights defenders have released shocking footage taken inside a slaughterhouse run by California's largest poultry producer. A videographer with the group Direct Action Everywhere used miniature infrared cameras to document workers slamming live chickens onto a concrete floor, failing to properly inspect birds, failing to stun birds before their throats are cut, and other abuses. Activists say Foster Farms workers are underpaid, ordered to remain on their feet for hours without breaks, and are forced by managers to work at a breakneck speed that prevents the humane treatment of animals. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is restoring protections for migratory birds that were gutted during the final days of Trump's presidency. A Trump administration rule change in January allowed companies that kill birds to largely avoid punishment under the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. The Interior Department says that rule change would have led to hundreds of millions of bird deaths per year. This week, the Biden administration said another 23 plant and animal species should be listed as extinct, including the ivory-billed woodpecker and several types of freshwater mussels. It's the latest example of an unprecedented loss of biodiversity due to climate change and humans' encroachment on natural habitats. In Italy, thousands of youth climate activists marched through the streets of Milan today, demanding world leaders meet their pledges to the Paris Climate Agreement and keep global temperatures from rising by more than 1.5 degrees Celsius. The protests came at the end of a 3-day climate conference ahead of the UN COP26 climate summit in Glasgow. On Thursday, several youth climate delegates were briefly detained by police after they held a peaceful protest ahead of a speech by the Italian prime minister. This is Ugandan climate activist Vanessa Nakate.
I and other activists will continue speaking, will continue striking, and will continue demanding for climate justice. And there is no climate justice without acknowledging that loss and damage is here with us now.
In labor news, today marks 13 days since dozens of New York taxi drivers began a round-the-clock protest outside City Hall, demanding relief for thousands of drivers who've been devastated by massive debt accrued largely due to the artificially inflated cost of taxi medallions. Data from 2019 shows medallion owner drivers, who are mostly immigrants, owe nearly $500,000 on average, even though the market value for medallions has drastically collapsed. Drivers are also denouncing the mental health impacts triggered by the financial ruin. At least 9 have died by suicide. In Chicago, workers at El Milagro tortilla plants led another protest Thursday against low pay, staff shortages, and abuse of working conditions, including intimidation and sexual harassment. The latest action comes after El Milagro management ignored workers' demands to meet and discuss their grievances. At a news conference, the workers announced they've also filed a formal labor complaint against El Milagro. Last week, workers walked off the job to denounce poor treatment. And in Canada, A judge dismissed a challenge by the Trudeau administration to a ruling that found the government underfunded First Nations children's services. The Canadian government was ordered to pay billions in compensation to the affected children, many of whom were forced into foster care as they had to leave their homes to access government services. This comes as Canada marked its first ever National Day of Truth and Reconciliation Thursday, in honor of the lost children and survivors of government and church-run schools for Indigenous children. Gatherings took place across Canada, including in Toronto.
Every single day, all of us are just fighting to get our culture back, and it was unfair of us to lose it. We should be living our lives on our reservations and on our land and getting our land back. And it's hard seeing all these people just be protesting something like this, a genocide. We're protesting a genocide. And it's emotional, very emotional.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, as the 20th anniversary of the opening of the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo approaches, we look back at the life and legacy of the pioneering radical lawyer Michael Ratner, who spent decades in the courts and streets fighting U.S. imperialism, including leading the effort to win habeas corpus rights for prisoners held at Guantanamo after the September 11th attacks. Michael died 5 years ago, but his memoir was recently published. It's titled Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer. Stay with us.
It's not a screen that you pass through, a shine in your eyes too bright, a pool outside of a window, being pulled by the changing light. I can look directly at
Diver by La 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 La. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. It's been nearly 20 years since George W. Bush opened the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo, where 779 men in total have been held overwhelmingly without ever being charged. They were tortured, held in isolation, stripped of their rights. President Biden is the fourth president to oversee Guantanamo, which is based at the U.S. Naval Base in Cuba. Today, 39 men remain, including at least 10 who've already been cleared for release but remain locked up. The military prison is only one part of the history of Guantanamo. In the early 1990s, the U.S. held over 12,000 Haitian asylum seekers at Guantanamo. On part of the base, the U.S. set up the world's first detention camp for refugees with HIV. Now the Biden administration's considering once again holding Haitians at Guantanamo. NBC recently reported that the Biden administration is advertising for a new contract to operate a migrant detention facility at Guantanamo with a requirement that some of the guards speak Spanish and Haitian Creole. Today, we look at the life and legacy of Michael Ratner, a trailblazing lawyer who worked to shut down the Guantanamo HIV camp in the 1990s, where Haitians were held, then later led to the fight to win habeas corpus rights for Muslim prisoners held at Guantanamo after the September 11th attacks. He was also a lifelong critic of war and U.S. imperialism. Michael Ratner died 5 years ago, but his influence on the legal community can still be felt. Orr Books recently published Michael's posthumous memoir, Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer. It details his involvement in decades of legal battles while working at the Center for Constitutional Rights. In a moment, we'll be joined by three guests who knew Michael well. But first, let's turn to Michael Ratner in his own words. Here he's speaking in 2007 when he was awarded the Puffin Nation Prize for Creative Citizenship.
Today, we're in the midst of a pitched battle. A pitched battle to put this country back, at least ostensibly, on the page of fundamental rights and moral decency. The battle is difficult, and the road is long and hard. On occasion, I get pessimistic. Sometimes I and my colleagues feel like Sisyphus. Twice, not just once, twice, we pushed the rock up the hill and won rights for Guantanamo detainees in the Supreme Court. And twice, the rock was rolled back down by Congress over those rights. So we pushed it back up again. 5 days ago, we were in the Supreme Court for the third time. It was difficult, more difficult than before, because the justices have changed. Four are antediluvians, lost forever to humanity. But before I get us all depressed, we've had our victories. We've gotten lawyers to Guantanamo, stopped the most overt torture, and freed half of the Guantanamo detainees, over 300. We have gotten Maher Arar out of Syria. Canada has apologized for his torture, given him a substantial recovery in Canadian dollars, which is no embarrassment anymore. They said he was an innocent man, but he remains on the U.S. terror list. We have slowed, but not yet stopped, a remarkable grab for authoritarian power. I also don't lose hope because I think about the early days of Guantanamo. At first, we were few, but now we are many. At first, when CCR began, we were the lonely warriors, taking on the Bush administration at Guantanamo. Now we are many. Now we, just on Guantanamo alone, are over 600 lawyers, most from major firms of every political stripe. These lawyers have an understanding of what is at stake, liberty itself. This struggle will be seen as one of the great chapters in the legal and political history of the United States. Today, war, torture, disappearances, murder surround us like plagues. Most in this country go on their way oblivious. Some don't want to know and are like ostriches. Some want to justify it all. Some want to make compromises. But be warned, we are at a tipping point into lawlessness and medievalism. We have our work to do. For each of us, the time for talking is long, long over. This is no time for compromise, no time for political calculation. As Howard Zinn admonishes us, it is the job of thinking people not to be on the side of the executioners. The Puffin Nation Prize reminds us all that the job for each of us is not to be on the side of the executioners. Thank you all.
Pioneering radical attorney Michael Ratner speaking in 2007 when he was awarded the Puffin Nation Prize for Creative Citizenship for his work heading up the Center for Constitutional Rights. Michael Ratner died in 2016, but his memoir, Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer, has just been published by Orr Books. We're joined right now by three guests who knew Michael well. Vince Warren is the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Lizzie Ratner is the niece of the late Michael Ratner and a senior editor at The Nation magazine. And Bahar Azmi is legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Bahar, I wanted to begin with you. If you can talk about Guantanamo, because this week we've got a federal court hearing the case of Guantanamo. You write, Michael Ratner knew from a lifetime fighting U.S. militarism, racism, and torture that Guantanamo, if unchecked, would become a centerpiece of American authoritarianism, where lawlessness and violence would redound across American democratic institutions. At the time, Guantanamo was the crown jewel of the Bush administration's war on terror. Since then, there has been President Obama, there's been President Trump, and now President Biden. But Guantanamo remains open, from 779 prisoners to, at this point, 39 prisoners. But it remains open. Can you talk about both Guantanamo and Michael Ratner's legacy in trying to get it shut down?
Thank you, Amy. It's stirring to hear Michael's words so clearly. I think he saw from the very beginning what everyone else perceived possibly as a necessary compromise. But what he saw is the possibility of creating a prison outside the law that was a marker of lawlessness and therefore authoritarianism that would single out, in this case, the most recent enemy, Muslims. Not unlike what he saw 10 years before with the demonization and exclusion of Black Haitian refugees. And what he saw is the connection between militarism and war and domestic forms of authoritarianism and repression. And that was a key to his intervention in Guantanamo. Because in bad things happen in dark places, not only bad things to the human beings locked up there, whose families are clamoring for understanding about what happened to them, but bad things happen to our institutions, our democratic institutions, to the arrogation of massive executive power, the dismissal of oversight by courts and the public. And so that intervention was critical to open up Guantanamo and expose the lies, torture, and incompetence that undergirded that project. And I think, excuse me, one thing he also saw and that we all recognize now is the continuity of Guantanamo in the American imperial project. Of course, it was taken in 1908 as part of an imperial project in the Spanish-American War and kept as a military base to undertake military-style missions. And initially, we talked about Guantanamo as exceptional. But as you note, it's here 20 years later. And I think given the way in which we've solidified borders, militarized domestic police forces, and all sorts of entailments from the post 9/11 world, Guantanamo isn't particularly exceptional. Fighting against it is critical, but fighting against it, recognizing it's at the sort of core of American forms of repression, is a key understanding that I think he knew well.
I wanted to bring Lizzie Ratner into the conversation, editor at The Nation magazine, the niece of Michael Ratner. Let's talk about this latest. There's this possibility, at least NBC is reporting, of putting Haitians, refugees, asylum seekers, once again in Guantanamo. And let's be clear, this is originally Guantanamo, the idea of putting them outside the reach of U.S. law. But if you can talk about back in the 1990s, when Haitian refugees fleeing a coup in Haiti are then put by Bush at Guantanamo, up to 12,000 people, and Michael's role in trying to shut that down.
Well, first, Amy, thank you so much for having me on, and thank you for having all of us on to talk about Michael. It is always wonderful to talk about him, his work, and his legacy. And the history of Guantanamo and the Haitian history of Guantanamo is crucially important to understanding what we're seeing now, both still with the sort of detention of detainees there, of Muslim detainees from the so-called war on terror, and then also what we're seeing now with Haitian refugees being sent back to Haiti. So it's a crucial moment to understand. As you pointed out, in 1991, there was a U.S.-backed coup. That's important to say, when the leftist leader of Haiti was kicked out of the country, and there was horrible, horrible, horrible repression in Haiti. So many Haitians who were working people, average everyday people, people of the left, fled in desperation. They were being attacked. And the United States, which had for years backed dictators in Haiti, said, we don't want Haitians coming here. We don't want to take these refugees of the coup that we backed. So we're going to prevent them from arriving in the United States. And this is a sort of a key part of the law to understand. If someone arrives in the United States, they have a right to make an asylum claim. And the United States has to keep them here while they entertain that claim. So how do you prevent people from making legitimate asylum claims? You prevent them from coming to the United States. And so what the United States did at the time, under Bush initially and then under Clinton, was that they rounded up Haitians who were coming to the United States on small boats on the high seas. They had the Coast Guard pick them up, and they took them to Guantanamo. And they said, this isn't really the United States, so you don't have actual rights here. And then they processed people on Guantanamo to determine whether or not they had a credible fear of persecution, which is a standard for asylum in the United States. Anyone they found not to have a credible fear, and there's probably a lot of debate about how well they made those judgments, but anybody who did not have a credible fear, they sent back to Haiti. But they warehoused many people on Guantanamo while they were trying to determine if they had a credible fear. And this is crucial, they forcibly tested people who had a credible fear, who could have made legitimate asylum claims. They forcibly tested them for HIV. And when they found that several people had HIV, they refused to let them into the United States, despite the fact that people would have had credible claims to asylum. They could have gotten asylum here. They could have begun an asylum case. And that's because there was horrible bigotry and racism against Haitians and against people with HIV and AIDS. And so rather than bringing people to the United States, they kept them on Haiti because they said, well, at least we're not sending them back to Haiti. So they kept Haitians on this, you know, in this prison camp, the world's first HIV detention center prison camp, a plague colony. We created it in the United States. And they kept several hundred Haitians there for well over a year. And Michael, with the lawyer Harold Coe at Yale Law School and a whole bunch of law students at Yale, said, this is outrageous. The United States is sort of trying to play footsie with the law. It's saying that people on Guantanamo, that Guantanamo isn't part of the United States, and therefore the U.S. law doesn't extend to Guantanamo. The protections of U.S. law don't exist there. And so he was fighting at the most basic level to get people out of horrible, horrible conditions. And then also to say that the United States couldn't create this kind of sinkhole in which it could do whatever it wants, dispense with the law, and just kind of, you know, play all kinds of illegal games. And so I think that moment is really crucial to understanding two things, and then I'll stop talking. But I think it's crucial to understanding both the later work that Michael and the CCR did on Guantanamo with regard to detainees and the so-called war on terror. And it's really crucial to understanding what's happening now with Title 42. The United States is once again seeing people from Haiti who could make asylum claims, and they're saying, we don't want you to come in. We want to circumvent this whole process, and we're going to just send you back or possibly send you to Guantanamo.
Vince Warren, if you can talk more about this and this trajectory from the early 90s to what we're seeing today. You started as an Ella Baker Fellow at Center for Constitutional Rights. You're now the executive director of CCR and worked with Michael for decades.
Yes, thank you so much for having me, Amy. And it's wonderful to be on with Bahar and Lizzie. And, you know, picking up on what Lizzie was talking about, you know, Michael, people might misperceive what Michael is about by just focusing on the specter of Guantanamo. So, yes, Michael did decades of work on that particular institution and in that legal, the context of preventing the legal black hole. But people should remember that, you know, Guantanamo has become iconic largely as a negative icon, largely because of Michael's work. But what it actually really represents is, number one, that we now have seven presidents since that time, six or seven presidents, that have used Guantanamo as an offshore prison where they claim that the law doesn't apply to dump all of the people that are causing problems in terms of how they are working the question of border security or national security. And so what Michael was able to do, even back in the 90s, when a lot of folks were like, well, I don't see what the big deal is, A, or B, I see what the big deal is, but how the heck would you challenge that legally? Doesn't the government have a right to keep us safe from people that have HIV by putting them, you know, in Guantanamo? Michael saw that conceding the legality of a black hole structure in the United States would turn into something like Guantanamo, that there would be other people that would be put there. In fact, you know, I think history has shown, if you look at some of the FBI documents that are emerging now, that folks on the left, radicals, people that want a greater society, folks like myself, there were plans to put us and people like us in these types of camps. So Michael was really pushing the framework that if we allow the government to create a law-free zone, it will create a legality around clearly illegal activity. The other thing that I would want to point out, just to draw it together, is the Guantanamo, the Haitian HIV situation, the Guantanamo detainees after 9/11, and the proposal to situate refugees and migrants in Guantanamo today by the Biden administration all share a mythology. And the mythology is one of a great and consuming irrational fear on the part of the United States citizenry about feeling safe. So in the 1990s, HIV was the thing that made people lose their minds in terms of fear, even though they didn't understand the disease. I mean, it's when you read the court papers, you know, Michael and Harold had to explain to the government and to the court that you couldn't catch HIV by talking to people. But yet and still, there was hysteria around the question of HIV and what it was going to do. In the context of 9/11, the hysteria was around terrorism. Every brown, black, Muslim, South Asian, Arab person, none of those people, but with a turban, represented an irrational fear in the United States. And we wanted to keep those people out in any way possible. And now, with respect to what's happening at the southern border, and, you know, in terms of our work at the Center for Constitutional Rights and the ACLU's work around asylum seeking, in the Trump administration, the irrational fear was overrunning the border. In the Biden administration, the irrational fear is COVID. So in each one of these contexts, it's fueled by, although not really in response to, it's fueled by an overarching hysteria that we have in the United States that makes people want to side with incarceration and dehumanization in order to keep themselves feeling safe.
I also now wanted to turn to the whole controversy around Yale University professor Samuel Moyne's recent piece in the New York Review of Books titled Michael Ratner's Tragedy and Ours. The piece is excerpted from Moyne's new book, Humane: How the United States Abandoned Peace and Reinvented War. In the piece, the Yale professor writes, quote, "In the years after September 11, 2001, Michael Ratner set aside the why, whether, and how long of America's global wars and concentrated instead on legally battling for controls on how they proceeded. In the annals of recent history, no one, perhaps, has done more than this leader of the Center for Constitutional Rights to enable a novel, sanitized version of permanent war. By legalizing the manner of the conflict, Ratner paradoxically laundered the inhumanity from what began as a brutal enterprise by helping to recodify a war that thus became endless, legal, and humane." Those are the words of Yale University professor Samuel Moyne. I want to go back to Bahar Azmi now. You recently co-wrote an article titled The Humanity of Michael Ratner, The Fabrications of Samuel Moyne. Can you respond to Professor Moyne?
Yeah, Amy, I think Professor Moyne makes the, to me, somewhat, although I haven't fully read his book, from what I understand, somewhat unoriginal observation that lawyers have populated defense departments, say in the United States or in the IDF, and lawyers inside those regimes have sought to make war slightly less lethal and within some sort of legal norms. But I suppose because that's, you know, a fairly standard claim, he goes further to make the provocative and ultimately, as we say, fraudulent claim that Michael Ratner is somehow in that camp. Michael opposed war with every fiber of his being, in every medium he had access to, the courtroom, the classroom, in the media. And he knew that legal challenges to protect humans from authoritarian abuses and violence and torture were necessary. That was his project in Guantanamo. And he also knew about the horrors of war and could manage both at the same time. So September 23rd, 2001, he gave a talk in which he said, this is not a lawful basis for the U.S. to engage in war. This is a crime under international law, citing the Nuremberg precedent, and argued that we should not pursue war, but pursue war crimes and crimes against humanity against the perpetrators. And over again, he was opposed to war. And the irony of sort of lumping Michael with people who try to make war humane, among many other pieces of evidence, Michael's project throughout the 2000s and before, from his experience in challenging war waged by the Clinton administration in Kosovo, is to say very specifically the idea of humanitarian war is impossible because it is just a mask for U.S. forms of hegemony. Professor Moyne has somewhat walked back his critique, suggested that the title was chosen by the editor and not him. But I think the content of his article, as you excerpted, stands and is profoundly misguided. Michael understood that lawyering has a particular role in society. It's not where the war is won, but is where the battle has to be fought alongside all other sorts of means to leverage the power of movements to challenge repression. That's what Michael stood for. And in no way did he ever sanitize war.
Lizzie Ratner, Michael Ratner, yes, was known for these court challenges from Guantanamo to actual wars, taking on Rumsfeld and others, suing against illegal war. But he also most deeply believed in the streets.
Yeah. You know, I just want to sort of echo what Bahar was saying. Reading Samuel Moyne's piece was a sort of out-of-body experience where you have somebody come in and speak very authoritatively and make really grand sweeping claims, which might sound credible, but then you realize, I know this person and this is actually sloppy and factually incorrect. So it was sort of a strange experience to read in the New York Review of Books, my uncle described in this way, which actually had no bearing on who he was or what he did. So, yeah, you know, prior to the war on terror, the so-called war on terror, Michael obviously was out in the streets and fighting legal battles on a whole array of topics. But I really want to focus on those last 15 years of his life, which could be looked at in one way as entirely an attempt to fight the so-called war on terror abroad and at home in whatever way he could. Michael believed that the law was a tool. It was one among many, but he had no great faith that the law was going to change everything. He believed that it was made by elites, by rich people, by the wealthy and the powerful, often as a way to hold on to that power. And so he talks in his book extensively about, you know, he was going to do what he could in the courts and then work with people on the streets. And I'll get to those sort of street examples in a moment, but I do want to quote from Michael's book since we are talking about it, and I think it provides a really powerful rebuttal to this claim by Samuel Moyne that Michael literally focused the last years of his life on sanitizing the war and didn't ask the why, wherefore, and how, and only questioned the manner in which war was fought. So Michael has a whole section on working with Julian Assange and on truth, what he calls truth tellers, which he sort of focused on at the end of his life. And he asks at one point, you know, why did I become so fixated on the stories of Chelsea Manning, of Julian Assange, of Snowden, of Jeremy Hammond? And he writes, I've asked myself, why are truth tellers like Assange, Manning, Snowden, and Hammond so important to me? The answer is that they have succeeded in doing what CCR and I have been trying to do ever since the so-called war on terror began in the wake of September 11, 2001. For more than a decade, we lawyers at CCR brought at least a dozen lawsuits seeking to expose and end rendition, illegal drone strikes, the war in Afghanistan and Iraq, and the torture at Guantanamo and other U.S. secret prisons. We tried to hold accountable those responsible for war crimes. Then I'll skip a little bit and he writes, then all of a sudden, people like Chelsea Manning, Julian Assange, Edward Snowden, Sarah Harrison, Aaron Swartz, and Jeremy Hammond came out of nowhere. With acts of great courage, they revealed to the world what this country is actually doing. They sparked a much-needed public discussion of the U.S. government's secret, illegal, and inhumane policies, and they brought people into the streets. And so I feel like I can talk extensively about Michael, but his own words tell the story of what he was trying to do, what he and CCR were trying so hard to do, which was attack war, attack this vast apparatus using whatever means they could. And so, of course, yes, he was also speaking all the time from early on, from right after 9/11. He was teaching. He was out there protesting. He was working with Code Pink and United for Peace and Justice. He was doing everything he possibly could to fight this war and these wars.
We're going to go to break. That's Lizzie Ratner. She's the niece of the late pioneering lawyer Michael Ratner and a senior editor now at The Nation magazine. We're talking to Vince Warren, who is the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, where Michael Ratner served as president, and Bahar Azmi, who is the Center for Constitutional Rights legal director. When we come back, I want to ask Vince Warren about those lawsuits against war in general. I remember when we interviewed Michael in Berlin when he was suing Donald Rumsfeld, the defense secretary under George W. Bush. Stay with us.
Oh, what did you see, my blue-eyed son? And what did you see, my darling young one? I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves all around it. I saw a highway of diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers bleeding. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken. I saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. And it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard. And it's a hard race. fall.
A hard rain is going to fall, Bob Dylan. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Back in 2006, attorneys with the Center for Constitutional Rights went to Berlin, Germany, to file a war crimes lawsuit in Germany against then-outgoing Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and other high-ranking U.S. officials for their role in the torture of prisoners in Iraq and Guantanamo. We spoke with then-CCR President Michael Ratner in Berlin.
What we did today was file a 220-page complaint. We've been working on this for quite a while against 14 high-level U.S. officials, Rumsfeld being the lead one, but of course General Sanchez being in there, Tenet, the head of the former head of the CIA, and a number of the lawyers who wrote some of the so-called torture memos, particularly lawyers Yu and Bybee. The procedure here is you file that complaint with the prosecutor, and the prosecutor then decides whether or not to begin an investigation. As you said, we did file a case, a similar case in 2004. The prosecutor in 2004 dismissed the case. He dismissed it really for legal reasons on the face of it, but for political reasons as well. The legal reasons, he said, was the United States, it appeared to him, was still investigating up the chain of command and was making an effort to look into who was responsible for the war crimes and the torture that went from Guantanamo to Abu Ghraib. We thought that was a wrong ruling then. We didn't think there was any evidence the U.S. was looking up the chain of command. But here we're now even in a different situation that makes that excuse really irrelevant and not possible again. Two things have happened. One is a year and a half has passed since we filed the last case, and of course nothing has been done to go after Donald Rumsfeld or Tenet or Sanchez or any of the other people we've named. So that alone says a lot about what the U.S. is doing. But as you also mentioned in your opening, that the U.S. has also immunized these people from war crimes. In the Military Commissions Act, which was signed by the president on October 17th, he amends the statute that makes violations of the Geneva Conventions criminal. That's called the War Crimes Act. He amends it not just going forward, but he amends it going backwards, back to 9/11/2001, essentially immunizing these officials in the United States from any prosecutions for war crimes. So now that we're in Germany, which is really a court of last resort, we can't go to the United States courts, we can't go to the international courts, they have no jurisdiction, you have to go to national courts. We're in Germany in part because it has the best law on universal jurisdiction, and in part because certainly in the past, and as far as we know today, some of the perpetrators are actually at military bases in Germany. Germany can no longer say, well, the U.S. is seriously investigating, because the U.S. has essentially immunized these defendants.
That's the late crusading human rights attorney Michael Ratner. His book has just come out posthumously, his memoir. It's called Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer. We're joined by three people who knew him well. Lizzie Ratner, his niece and editor at The Nation magazine. Bahar Azmi, the Center for Constitutional Rights legal director, where Michael served as president. And Vince Warren, the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. I don't know how many times, Vince, that I talked to you and talked to Michael about this, the challenges overall to war. And it's particularly important this week as we watch in the Senate and the House military leaders coming forward, being questioned in these inquiries around the last 2 weeks of the U.S. military troop presence in Afghanistan and the chaos that happened. They are willing to talk about the last few weeks, but no one in the House and Senate is holding a hearing on the entire last 20 years of the Afghanistan war. Talk about how Michael's critique would inform this and what you feel needs to happen.
Yeah, thank you, Amy. It's very emotional to see clips of Michael. That clip in Berlin happened, I think they filed that case 2 weeks, maybe after, no, sorry, a month after I started as executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. So it was really extraordinary. A few things. Number one, I want to just bring back Bahar's frame, which I think was Michael's frame, which is don't do war, don't pursue war, pursue war crimes. And that's essentially was a series of tools that Michael and also Peter Weiss, who was the vice president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and many other lawyers began to pursue. And this, as it became known, the Rumsfeld case, which was filed in Germany, also was accompanied by a case that was filed in France that was succeeded by a case that was filed in Switzerland, which actually kept George Bush and company from traveling to Switzerland under fear of arrest, which was part of Michael and Peter's vision for how we should be thinking about war when the U.S. insists upon waging it, and the U.S. citizenry insists upon backing it. What is notable, I think, from the hearings that we've been hearing on the Afghanistan withdrawal, particularly with respect to General Milley, has been that there has everyone in Congress seems to be really, really deeply concerned about the question of failure. And no one seems to be concerned about the question of killing and lawlessness. And had we had this level of congressional interest, congressional concern at the beginning, back in the days after 9/11, when Congress gave the president the green light to do whatever he wanted and abdicated its role under the War Powers Act, abdicated its role to be a check on the president in terms of waging war. If we had this level of engagement and intention at that point, we would not have been in Afghanistan for 20 years. Hundreds and thousands of Afghanis wouldn't have died. U.S. troops wouldn't have died. We would have had a different trajectory. But alas, in a society that is much more comfortable with recriminations 20 years later than being on the side of vision and right, as Michael was at the beginning when there is tremendous risk, this is what we end up with. I'll say this other thing about just connecting this to the Moyne piece is, you know, what Moyne is doing is essentially whitewashing the question of the roles of lawyers in pushing back on the great inhumanities that we inflict on each other. There were lawyers that filed lawsuits, largely unsuccessful, during the Nazi era. People didn't, they were not bystanders. There were lawyers that filed hundreds of lawsuits, as shown in Rick Abel's book, in South Africa, to challenge apartheid. And there are hundreds of lawyers that challenged quasi-successfully, actually, in the United States, the hegemonic tone and vector of the United States military and military might. This will be the essential function moving forward. We are not living an era where we can say, you know what, we don't need lawyers to be able to deal with the inhumanities of man, because we're going to see them under every administration, including this one. I have no doubt that there will be a military intervention at some point, particularly around the question of when people are reelected, that will require the vision of Michael. And I'm glad that Michael gave that to us at this point so that we can prepare it for the next thing.
Finally, the last word goes to another Ratner, to Lizzie Ratner. Lizzie, if you can talk about Michael as an institution builder. Yes, he helped to build the European Center for Constitutional and Human Rights, and also was seminal with Palestine Legal. And if you can talk about his commitment to Palestinian human rights.
Yeah. So Michael talks in the book a lot about both sort of his upbringing in a Zionist Jewish family in the United States and how he, over the years, really came to understand the story of Palestine, to understand the story of oppression, of ethnic cleansing, and sort of come to feel that his role could not be to sit on the sidelines, but was to join in and support in whatever way he could, you know, play the role of a supportive activist, support the struggle of Palestinians in the U.S. and, of course, in Palestine. And so he worked very closely with Dima Khalidi to start Palestine Legal, which does fierce and heroic work here in the United States, around the question of Palestinian speech rights. It's, you know, that we believe in free speech in this country, but often not around the question of Palestine. And so people who speak up, particularly people who are Palestinian, who speak up for Palestinian rights, end up sort of being silenced in all manner of ways. And so he felt very strongly that sort of the next chapter of his life would be around the issue of Palestine. And he was starting out and embarking on that when he became very sick. But it is beautiful to see the work. It's beautiful to see the work that they're doing at Palestine Legal, and also to see the work that CCR is doing in so many young lawyers who are pushing forward a radical theory of lawyering and also movement building.
I want to thank you all so much for being with us. Lizzie Rettner, niece of the late Michael Rettner, senior editor at The Nation magazine. Vince Warren, Center for Constitutional Rights executive director, and Bahar Azmi, legal director at CCR. The new book, Moving the Bar, My Life as a Radical Lawyer. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
McGill University's fourth annual Queer History Month is taking place this October. The featured keynote presentation is taking place from 6 to 7:30 p.m. on Friday, October 1st, with entomologist Jessica Ware of Rutgers University. Join in later in the month for more exciting programming, including a chat with an elder session from 5 to 6:30 p.m. on Tuesday, October 19th, a zine-making workshop on Thursday, October 21st from noon to 2 p.m., a trans and non-binary in academia panel discussion on Wednesday, October 27th from 6 to 8 p.m., and finally, a queer open mic night with performances by Opera Queens on Thursday, October 28th, also from 6 to 8 p.m. Visit the Equity at McGill webpages, www.mcgill.ca/equity, for a complete list of Queer History Month events organized by McGill's Office of the Provost and Vice Principal Academic and their partners. Queer History Month will be opened and closed by Elder Gawenodas Sedalio Fazio. The goal of McGill's Queer History Month is to raise awareness, advance education, and increase visibility of 2S LGBTQIA communities by recognizing their histories and contributions, building bridges, and bringing together McGill students, staff, faculty, and alumni, and Montreal community members.
Saturday, October 16th at The Ritz, Orquesta Criminal returns to the stage armed with their repertoire of ancient criminal tunes from